I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge the season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Novel.
Before we begin, a content warning. The following episode contains difficult themes and violence.
The young and able lawyer, Thomas E. Dewey, appointed special prosecutor to clean out the city's racketeers.
Mr. Dewey, you have been given a most difficult task, but the opportunity of helping the people of this city.
In the late 30s, the Republican Party produces a promotional film. It opens on a man. Dark, slick hair and a carefully groomed and distinct mustache talks into a heavy telephone, according to the no-nonsense voiceover. This is Thomas E. Dewey. An office full of workers at their desks enters the frame, arranged in neat lines like a classroom. They're all white men in suits, their hair shiny with pomade. They're busy going through paperwork, hard at their respective tasks for the day.
Dewey's small hand-picked staff began its attack on the underworld by ferreting out secret records and getting the frightened victims of the rackets to talk.
The back of a witness's head appears.
The man at the left is the man who hit my husband on the head with a pipe. The man directly behind him is the man who threatened to beat me and cut my hands off.
This film is a reenactment of Dewey's investigation into organized crime. Watching these films, you clearly see Dewey as a man dedicated to showmanship. A man already deeply enamored with the creation of his own legacy. Unfortunately, Dewey's hypnotizing baritone can't cover his stilted acting.
The cops who did that job worked day and night for a year. They're entitled to a promotion, and I think they ought to have it.
Maybe it's a good thing he went into law.
Painstakingly accumulating evidence, Dewey and his men, working with city police, begin building up their cases.
Only, it wasn't just Dewey and his men responsible for the investigation. There was one person, one woman in particular, who was really the mastermind. And for just a moment, so quick you may not even notice, I see her. While Dewey holds court, face always clear, she sits at a table with her back to the camera. Eunice Hunton Carter. But what good is a seat at the table when no one acknowledges that you built the table? From the teams at iHeartRadio and Novel, I'm Nicole Perkins, and this is The Godmother. Episode 5, Up All Night to Get Lucky. The daytime commute to the Woolworth building must look familiar, but strange to Eunice. She's used to arriving there in the evening for her law school studies, but now she's walking into the elevators during the bustle of the day. And instead of the 28th floor for classes, she steps out onto the 14th floor for work.
When Eunice got off the elevator, I think she would have seen a buzz of activity, but it was pretty low key. There was this air of secrecy about it. I mean, there had to be. Dewey did not want people to know where they were, what they were doing.
From the plainclothes police officers patrolling the building's lobby to the telephone equipment secured against illegal tapping, there are tamper-proof file cabinets tucked inside a bank vault. Venetian blinds keep people from spying. It's October 1935, and a special prosecution is underway. Dewey has a hand-picked team of 20 attorneys, plus investigators, clerks, assistants, stenographers, and a select group of NYPD officers, and of course, Eunice Hunton Carter. As Eunice walks toward her desk that day, does she worry about trying to prove herself? Or does she worry about appearing too confident? The news of her appointment to Dewey's team arrived with whispers that it was her connection to Harlem that earned her spot, and not her skills or experience. In other words, was she hired just because she's Black? Maybe those whispers help motivate her, and there's nothing wrong with using her Harlem background to move forward.
There were a lot of people in Harlem who were like, no, I'm not going to talk to Thomas Dewey and his other 19 white male prosecutors about this. Like, I'm fine. We can handle this in our own community.
Access to that community is crucial to Dewey in these first few months of his team's investigation, because they are targeting the numbers racket, and at its head, the wild, reckless mobster associate of Lucky Luciano's, Dutch Schultz.
Who had come in and taken control of the Harlem numbers racket, essentially strong-armed a number of Black men and women in Harlem who'd run their own numbers games.
Dutch is still battling with numbers running queen Stephanie St. Clair. Dutch is a figurehead of Dewey's crusade against organized crime. His plan? Use one high-profile mobster as the focus. Build him up in the press as the root of all evil, then quickly take him down. Of course, that only works if Dewey gets his target, and fast. Dutch is all too aware of this renewed heat on him. So, Dutch creates his own plan.
Hey, we need to kill Thomas Dewey.
But someone unexpected is watching Dewey's back.
Dutch Schultz went to Lucky Luciano and said, hey, we need to get rid of him because he's trying to get rid of us.
And Lucky gives Dutch a response that will alter the course of his life.
Lucky Luciano said, no, we will not kill Dewey because if we do that, then they'll really be after us. Dutch Schultz did not listen. He hired a hitman.
One morning, October 24th, 1935, as Eunice weaves her way across the bustling office to get to her desk, the clanging sounds of phones ringing is even more urgent and nonstop than ever before. There is a shocking development in the mob world.
Unfortunately for Dutch Schultz, it was Dutch Schultz who got assassinated.
Schultz's death was a huge blow for Dewey.
Eunice and Dewey's investigation into Dutch Schultz has hit a sudden dead end, literally.
Difficult to imagine just how much of a, like, oh, crap moment they had, because they were building their whole case on taking down Schultz.
Dewey needs a new public enemy number one, and it has to be someone even more high profile than Dutch, because Dewey has wasted a lot of time and money on the Dutch false start. He needs results, and soon. There is, of course, only one person who really fits the bill as Dutch's replacement.
The new unofficial boss of bosses.
There is a new mugshot from that heroin in a hat box drug dealing charge a few decades ago that Dewey pins on the corkboard in that 14th floor office.
Dewey carved out a prosecution against Charles Lucky Luciano that would garner a great deal of publicity, even in a jaded city like New York.
But what about Eunice, a rookie prosecutor who's been selected for her special knowledge about Harlem and Dutch Schultz? What does she bring to the table now?
Thomas Dewey needs to figure out something to do with her. He puts her on sort of this dead-end project.
A beat no one particularly wants.
Carter is primarily tasked with talking to every member of the New York community who comes in and has a complaint about prostitution.
And it turns out, one thing New Yorkers want to talk about is prostitution.
It's really easy to say this is sexism or this is racism, but I also think that Dewey knew that they needed a woman to talk to people. Average, regular New Yorkers who walk into the office every single day complaining about disorderly houses, as they're often referred to at the time period. I do think that Dewey respected her enough to know, hey, you know this stuff. Let's see if you can make anything out of it. And she did.
During the fall and into winter of 1935, when citizens entered the Woolworth Building, they received directions to Eunice. Is listening to these complaints and the resultant paperwork supposed to be grunt work for Eunice, something to keep her precious little black female mind occupied while the big boys did all the real work of the law? Whatever the motivation for pushing Eunice away from the action and into glorified secretarial work, people from all walks of life are landing at Eunice's desk. Businessmen, parolees, and perhaps most importantly, sex workers themselves. The info coming in is almost overwhelming. New York's sex work industry is thriving. Eunice needs to connect these low-level vice complaints to these big-shot mobsters. And she knows there's something in all those complaints she's receiving. Something crucial. She just hasn't quite put the jigsaw puzzle together yet. But Eunice doesn't mind having so many small, seemingly innocuous pieces of info spread across her desk. She lives for the details. And as more and more tip-offs pile up in front of her, a pattern begins to emerge.
She hears about Louis Wiener. Everyone pretty much knew this guy was a booker for the brothels.
Eunice recognizes this name from her time at the women's court. Other familiar names keep appearing.
People talk about Abe Karp, who is one of these attorneys who she remembers from her time on women's court.
This is a lawyer whose name appeared to be all over the booking forms of the sex workers who managed to avoid successful prosecution.
Carter starts piecing together all this information.
In the women's courts where they prosecute prostitution cases, Eunice Carter had seen a pattern of corruption that led her to believe that the world of New York prostitution had been infiltrated by the mob.
Eunice suspects she's onto something, but she needs more proof. Her slick-haired colleagues down the hall might be able to get away with hunches and wild goose chases, but she knows she needs irrefutable evidence. She heads to the women's court archives to try to tie together more threads.
Her forte was going through documents and patience. So when she was in the women's court in the prosecutor's office, many of the cases involved prostitution. And so she's going through these records, she's processing them.
She's also reading through her old caseload when she was at the women's court and trying to figure out how many times certain names come up, how many times certain alibis come up, how many times does she see the exact same monetary figures being discussed.
She just starts every once in a while finding the name of an attorney that is an expensive attorney. There's two or three of these. After going through hundreds of these, she must have gotten to the point where she's thinking, there's no way these prostitutes could afford these attorneys. She brings this up to another person on the team. What do you think of this? I think she was thinking, am I crazy? What do you think of this? And the other person on the team said, no, there's got to be something here.
Eunice keeps listening to the citizen complaints as they roll in. She keeps squinting through chicken scratch and blurring ink. Everything was handwritten or typed on a typewriter then. No pocket-sized devices with screens you can double-tap to zoom in. Eunice is probably weighed down with file folders of complaints, pens, writing pads, copies of court documents. I wonder if she sometimes carries any of her work home before stopping at the grocery store or butcher, while her coworkers stop at a bar for a drink, or maybe even one of the disreputable houses she's cross-referencing in all her paperwork.
Painstaking, painstaking work.
But slowly, the beginnings of a promising case have begun to develop.
She brought that suspicion to Thomas Dewey and said, this is an area where maybe we can focus our investigation.
She probably knows every response Dewey's team could use to discredit her idea to focus on vice. It's just a bunch of crazies, just a bunch of women. How can we trust these prostitutes who are probably just trying to get lesser charges? This is small-time stuff compared to the big mob guys. But she knows differently. Some men need cameras and a spotlight to fail up in life, and some women need the trust of their fellow citizens and a quiet archive to succeed. And Eunice tells Dewey she is convinced this is how they can get to Lucky.
We're not going to charge him with murder, even though Luciano murdered a lot of people, not even tax evasion. We don't have the numbers, but we can go after prostitution.
Dewey was initially very skeptical.
Dewey says, no, come on. First of all, the mob's not involved in prostitution. And second, Dewey, very public relations minded, said, I'm not going after a bunch of poor, penniless prostitutes in a mob case. Forget it.
Eunice does not forget it. This is not the first time her hard work has been dismissed. If she accepted a no every time someone questioned her, she wouldn't have even made it to Dewey's team in the first place. Ambition doesn't believe in rejection. That's just a detour. Eunice knows she's onto something. So she keeps working the leads and keeps finding undeniable patterns.
She goes back to her friend on the team and said, there's got to be something here. I just think there is.
Murray Gerfein is one of Eunice's colleagues. Maybe he's a work friend. As a Jewish man, he probably also knows what it's like to have to prove himself constantly. And maybe Eunice realizes she'll need the support of at least one man to get Dewey to listen to her. Two outsiders, one Black woman, one Jewish man, working together are better than one. And as too many working women know, sometimes you have to get a man to repeat exactly what you've just said to get other men to listen.
The two of them persuaded Dewey. I mean, they had to go back to Dewey a couple times, and Dewey finally said, okay, maybe there's something here.
But Dewey wants even more evidence. Because even if sex work is connected to the mob, how does that help tie it to their specific high-profile investigation? Well, Eunice has an answer for that, too.
She gets his permission to start wiretapping to piece together who these people are, what they know, who works for whom, and try to figure out who is at the top.
Because Luciano, unlike those more high-profile, flamboyant Irish and Jewish mobsters of that era, he was surrounded by this cone of silence.
But this isn't a case of tapping a few phones of a few gangsters. This is going to require extensive wiretapping. And in 1930s New York, that means something a little more complicated than calling up a phone company with a warrant.
Dewey ordered Eunice Carter and another man on the team, Murray Gerfein, to essentially create a list of dozens of people that they wanted to wiretap.
And then they have to physically get hardware onto all these people's phone lines across New York. Sometimes detectives pay or strong arm telephone repairmen to go into buildings and place small microphones into mouthpieces or replace old phones with newer ones with mics already installed.
They wiretapped incredibly liberally.
They kick off by wiretapping the bookers and bondsmen's offices of New York. But soon they're intercepting calls from offices of mob members, too. If there's a phone there, it's not safe.
Wiretapping laws in the 1920s and 30s were still very much up in the air. And in New York, wiretapping laws are a lot looser than in most of the rest of the country. They took a lot of connections through these telephone conversations. Thousands of hours of wiretaps that Eunice Carter and the rest of the team had to sift through in order to do this.
And as they do, Eunice and the team discover more evidence that Eunice's suspicions might be correct.
New York prostitution was in the process of being organized by organized crime.
They're able to tie sex work to the mob.
One man named Little Baby Patillo and one man named Tommy the Bull Pinocchio.
You might recognize that last name as one of the Mott Street Boys.
The suspicion was Little Davy and Tommy the Bull were working for Lucky Luciano, that there was this whole cadre of middlemen who were running prostitution and victimizing the prostitutes and the madams in New York City.
Eunice may have felt like they were right on the edge of the big breakthrough. Here are direct links to the team's big target, Lucky Luciano.
What she realized is that the gangsters were very vulnerable on this. Not only was prostitution illegal, but the whole story of prostitution was fairly brutal, and it had such tabloid qualities to it.
After months of building all of this up, they finally talk Dewey into a raid.
The team begins planning an operation that will go down in history. This isn't going to be the usual kind of raid. Cops running into a single location and arresting a handful of people. No, this is something much bigger.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us. They burned us and subject us to really horrible, cruel and unusual punishment.
After my personal experience at Provo Canyon School, I was shocked to learn that a man named Robert Litchfield, a man who got his start at the school that I went to, would go on to create a multi-million dollar empire.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's in treatment.
The Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs in Schools.
They prey on, you know, a parent's really natural and beautiful love for their children in a really, really, unfortunately, effective way.
At this time in my life now, if someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, sham, scam, beware.
Listen to season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's so much going on. It is madness. It is chaos.
On the night of February 1st, 1936, Eunice Carter arrives yet again on the 14th floor of the Woolworth Building. She may have been used to all the commotion on the floor, but nothing could prepare her for the scene she sees that night.
Literally, there would have been people just all over. Floors, benches, private rooms, not private rooms. Everyone just sort of working feverishly. No one's got a laptop in 1936. 20 stenographers are working around the clock with their giant legal pads and their pencils, with their little notebooks. You got people who've brought their typewriters in with them, feverishly taking notes of their statements through the night and the early morning. Keep in mind that this is February in New York, so it is snowy and disgusting and wet, and people are freezing cold. You've got cops in uniform. You've got plainclothes who were prepared to act as Johns. There's so much going on. It is madness. It is chaos.
For once, the office is also full of other women, 88 of them in total, most of them sex workers, madams.
And many of these women have been arrested in the middle of a transaction. And so some of them are wearing coats and some of them are not wearing coats. And some of them have on $1,000 furs.
As Eunice stands in that room, absorbing the chaos, I wonder if she can tell that this case will be the one she'd be remembered for. I wonder if she felt proud of herself, if she thought she'd finally be recognized for her hard work. All of that night's madness starts at precisely 8:55 p.m.
This is coordinated to the minute.
160 plainclothes policemen from across New York gather together in Manhattan. The cops are divided so that they're working with colleagues they've never worked with before.
One would be on West 57th Street. One would be on East 36th. I mean, they were just all over the place.
They're split into teams of 2 and 3. Each team is given an envelope
with an address on it. And at exactly 9:05, they all opened their envelopes and read the instructions inside.
These instructions dispatch the cops to top secret locations across the city. Like something out of a modern day reality game show, none of them know what they're getting into until they open the envelope.
The instructions said, go to this address and arrest everybody inside and bring them to the Woolworth Building.
The police look at each other. This is clearly an operation like no other.
They want to make sure that when they are arresting, they are not just taking women out of brothels. They want women across the city caught in the act.
At 9 p.m., cops set off. Once they reach their assigned locations, they start kicking down doors. As they pour up stoops and staircases and into apartment buildings across New York, they emerge with men, but mostly women, in handcuffs. It's quickly apparent. The element of surprise has been a success.
Best we can tell, they do wind up arresting about 110 people. Those individuals are later detained. The other, like, 20 or so are mostly Johns. They couldn't care less. These guys are not going to help them get to Luciano, so they let him go.
There were 88 arrests altogether. It was a pretty wild night, even for a city like New York.
And now, back at the Woolworth Building, as Eunice and Dewey survey the scene before them, they're already contemplating the next mammoth task ahead.
The idea was they were going to arrest the madams and the prostitutes and hold them as material witnesses and force them to give testimony against the middle management types, Battillo and Pinocchio, and ultimately force them to flip and implicate Lucky Luciano as the head of prostitution in New York.
Getting sex workers to snitch is no small feat because they've become used to a specific type of mob protection from law enforcement.
The women were used to being arrested. They all had been arrested dozens of times. So they assumed it was business as usual. They weren't going to cooperate. They wouldn't give their real names. They were blowing the prosecutors off.
A fair chunk of their earnings goes to the mob for occasions just like this. That had been the promise of the mob's move into sex work. You pay us, we'll protect you. We'll bail you out. We'll set you up with some of the best representation the justice system has to offer. But tonight, the women wait and wait and wait. No one seems to be coming.
The men who normally got them out were no longer there, and they realized, uh-oh, something different's going on.
That's because the night before, there had been another round of secret arrests.
16 men on January 31st, 1936.
The operation had been very discreet. And now, as minutes turned to hours in the holding cells, the mob guaranteed bookers and lawyers who usually come to bail out the women are a no-show. And the women realize nobody is coming to help this time. So a new chapter of Eunice's work begins, because now she and the rest of Dewey's team have to figure out how much these women know and how they might be connected to Lucky Luciano.
The prostitution racket is so tricky because there's women who are both madams and prostitutes, and then also wives of bookers. Maybe they have a relationship with Luciano, but maybe they don't have a relationship with Luciano.
The longer it takes to get their ducks in a row, the more time the mob has to regroup, reorganize, and hide.
People like Eunice Carter start personally interviewing these women almost immediately. She is working around the clock.
Those in custody don't get any sleep that night either, which may have been a deliberate ploy.
They were doing everything they can to just get as much information as quickly as possible.
Intentional sleep deprivation is recognized as a form of torture today. Eunice probably justifies this part of the operation as for the greater good, or even just for a personal win. Could she have done anything about it anyway, once the ball was rolling? In the end, these considerations don't matter, because none of the sex workers talk.
So what happened was Dewey called a special judge to come down to the Woolworth Building on Sunday, and he arraigned all 87 prostitutes and madams as material witnesses on bonds ranging from $10,000 to $25,000. In today's dollars, $10,000 is like $180,000, okay? No way these women could have come up with what amounts to $180,000 each to get out of jail. So basically, Dewey put these women in jail on a bond they could never meet and held them incommunicado in the women's house of detention for months.
For months, without conviction, or even a trial. After the raids on the brothels, As the days stretch into weeks and into months, Eunice essentially starts working her way into the minds of these women. She's now at the center of the investigation, talking constantly to the women and eventually establishing relationships with them. Some of these women become cooperating witnesses.
She knew how smart women could be. She knew how much knowledge of their own that they had that other people wouldn't have. And that is really what made her so valuable, both to starting the investigation and continuing the investigation.
Eunice knows from firsthand experience how often women are overlooked in rooms with men, how men will talk and share secrets as if women are just pieces of furniture. And yet, she's exploiting that knowledge for her boss, a man who wouldn't take her seriously until she had another man to back up all the hard work she'd put into this case.
Many of the women were in pretty bad shape when they were picked up. A lot of these girls were drug addicts.
Certainly in the first 3 or 4 hours, this is less of a concern.
But as those hours stretch into days, the withdrawal symptoms become agonizing.
They were strung out. They were addicts. They would have to suffer a cold turkey cure on the floor of a jail cell. They held that over their heads. All right, you want a hospital, sweetheart, or you want a jail cell? Which is it? If you want a hospital, we can do that for you, but you got to talk.
Finally, the women start telling Eunice what she wants to hear, including a very specific name.
So now it was time to find out how many times they had heard Charlie Lucky referred to in conversation. That was what they built their case on. So while these revelations were being recorded, a case was being built against Charles Lucky Luciano.
But if Eunice and Dewey think they'll be seeing Lucky in handcuffs anytime soon, they're out of luck. Lucky is nowhere to be found.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The train from New York to Hot Springs, Arkansas takes 35 hours at a minimum. As you arrive in town, one of the first things you notice, despite the lingering hold of winter 1936, is just how many people there are out in the streets.
Just packed with people, constantly packed with people, year round. You'd walk from the train station, which is about four blocks from here, to the National Park, and you'd walk down Central Avenue where there were 22 high-rise hotels, a lot of casinos. All the bathhouses are open, either doing baths or as bed and breakfasts. There's a brewery where they brew beer from the thermal water, even during Prohibition, because we had a hell of a moonshine industry here.
This small town is booming.
The New York Times called it America's first resort because people could come here, they could fish, they could swim, they could hike and drink, they could gamble. Prostitution industry grew here. It was a man's world back then.
In 1936, Hot Springs, Arkansas is a must-see destination for a particular type of traveler.
100,000 people coming here to take baths. That was really the main attraction, even for the mob to begin with.
That's right. Hot Springs isn't just a spa town. It's a mafia town.
There were a lot of underworld characters that were cooling off in Hot Springs.
What a brochure slogan that is. They're everywhere, in the bars, brothels, and casinos, or just casually strolling down Main Street in their unmistakable wide pinstripes and double lapels. But the people of Hot Springs don't seem to mind them.
If you need to take some R&R off of what you've been doing, and you don't want to get killed doing it, you come to Hot Springs. Nobody bothered them. Everybody talked to them. Hey, you're looking Luciano. How are you? I mean, they were gentlemen. They were dressed nice. They had a lot of money. They were super polite, big tippers. You know, who's going to start trouble with the mob, you know, in the middle of Hot Springs, Arkansas?
You know, the old Rolling Stones lyric, every cop is a criminal. That was especially true in the 1930s and in Hot Springs, Arkansas, because it was known as a cooling off area where if they paid enough money, they could be protected.
And the club of infamous gangsters taking advantage of this gets an update in March 1936, when Lucky Luciano also starts calling the town home. Ever since those February raids on brothels across Manhattan, feeling the net closing in, he swaps the murky waters of New York for the healing waters of Hot Springs. During that spring of 1936, two unfortunate New York burglars break the Hot Springs etiquette, and so
the Hot Springs Police Department called a couple of New York cops to come down and pick up a couple of New York burglars who they captured here. While they were here, they were walking around like everybody else, and they spotted Luciano walking on the promenade. And they said, Lucky, the whole East Coast is looking for you. He said, what for? And he told him compulsory prostitution, and he just laughed. He said, I can't believe that, but anyway, I appreciate you telling me. So, of course, the policeman that had spotted him here, when he got back to New York with his prisoner, he said, you know, I saw Lucky Luciano down there. They said, what? He said, yeah, he's walking down the promenade. He's fixing to go take a bath. So that stirred up you-know-who.
Thomas Dewey, back in New York, who was waiting to complete his mission.
He got on the phones and he started calling and sending telegrams and raising hell. Arrest Lucky and bring him back to New York.
Unfortunately for Dewey, it isn't quite that simple. He's paid his fees to the cops.
They were more interested in protecting Luciano than they were in cooperating with Dewey.
After several days, the governor of Arkansas calls Hot Springs and kicks the sheriff into action. The sheriff brings Lucky in on a traffic violation.
They were forced to go pick him up. He spent a few hours over at the Garland County Jail. He had an open door policy at the jail. You can come and go if you want to go get some sandwiches or something. That's fine.
But his lawyers in Hot Springs get in touch with his lawyers up in New York. And before long, Lucky gets bailed out.
Arkansas really wasn't going to make a move to take him anywhere.
So the governor intervenes again, this time with a little more aggression.
The governor in Arkansas sent 20 armed state troopers to Hot Springs to take Luciano physically from Hot Springs to Little Rock.
From there, he's extradited back to New York with an armed escort. After all the hullabaloo, no one wants to be the one accused of letting Lucky Luciano get away. The train ride back to New York is uneventful. The cops keep Lucky handcuffed between them at all times. When he arrives in New York,
Eunice Carter was there ready for him.
On April 8, 1936, Lucky's indicted for 90 counts of compulsory prostitution. The judge sets his bond at $350,000. At the time, it's the largest bond in New York history.
That's about almost $8 million in today's dollars.
Lucky doesn't pay it. So while sitting in his jail cell, he has the chance to read his arrest warrant. He notices a significant detail. Lucky isn't going to be tried alone. 12 of his associates are being indicted alongside him.
Having everybody tried under one indictment, that was called the Joinder Law. That was pretty revolutionary for its time. And it was a sneaky trick that prosecutors used to lump all these defendants under one category.
Behind the scenes, Dewey has been lobbying for a new law. As they'd built the case against Lucky, he realized how hard it would be to link the mob's top bosses to the actions of their lieutenants and middlemen. And so he's been trying to find a way to get them all in court together. Legislators back him up. They put the law into effect at breakneck speed.
That law actually passed like days before the Luciano trial.
The rules of the game have changed. Find one guilty and you find them all guilty. This law is a big deal. A huge deal, in fact. It's a precursor to the RICO law, or Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act. The RICO law is still in use today and has been used against all kinds of people and companies, from John Gotti to Donald Trump to Shein Fashion Company.
The guilt of innocence of one was the same as the guilt or innocence of another.
It becomes known as the Dewey Law. Dewey is determined not to let Lucky slip through the cracks of the judicial system, even if it means he has to seal them himself.
At that point, he knew he was toast.
After months of painstaking work, of morally dubious evidence collection, of office politics and lobbying, Eunice's master plan is about to bring New York's most powerful gangster into the courtroom. Will it pay off? Lucky and Eunice were set on different trajectories the minute they arrived in New York in 1906. And now, with Thomas Dewey between them,
their lives intersect in a courtroom for 1 month in 1936.
That's coming up on episode 6 of The Godmother. You've been listening to...
I'm Marilyn Greenwald. I'm a professor emerita of journalism at Ohio University, and I'm the author of 5 biographies, including one of Eunice Hunton Carter.
I am Claire White, and I am the director of education at the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas.
My name is Dr. Clarissa Myrick Harris. and I am a tenured professor of Africana Studies at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia.
My name is Robert Whalen, and I'm an emeritus professor of history at Queen's University of Charlotte here in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, my name is Ellen Olson. I research and I write books about women who were involved with notorious gangsters and desperados.
My name is Chuck Greaves. Before becoming a writer, I spent 25 years as a Los Angeles trial lawyer. My fourth novel was basically a fictionalization of the famous 1936 Vice trial, in which Lucky Luciano was prosecuted by Thomas Dewey.
I'm Debbie Applegate. I'm a historian and biographer, and I am the author of Madam, the biography of Polly Adler, icon of the jazz age.
Robert Raines, author of Hot Springs from Capone to Costello, executive director of the Gangster Museum of America, located in Hot Springs National Park, Arkansas.
The Godmother is produced by Novel for iHeartRadio. For more from Novel, visit novel.audio. The Godmother is hosted and written by me, Nicole Perkins. Our producer is Leona Hamid. Additional production from Adjua Jima Brimpong, Ronald Young Jr., and Zayana Yusuf. Our editor is Adjua Jima Brimpong. Additional story editing from Max O'Brien and Mithili Rao. And our researcher is Zayana Yusuf. Additional research from Mohammed Ahmed. David Waters is our executive producer. Field production by Tanita Romani and Palace Shaw. Sound design, mixing, and scoring by Daniel Kempson. Our score was written, performed, and recorded by Jeff Parker. Music supervision by Nicholas Alexander and David Waters. Production management and endless patience from Cherie Houston, Sarah Tobin, and Charlotte Wolf. Fact-checking by Fendel Fulton and Danya Suleiman. Story development by Madeline Parr, Jess Swinburne, and Zayana Yusuf. Willard Foxton is our creative director of development. Special thanks to Leah Carter, Stephen Carter, Angela J. Davis, Andrew Fernley, Marilyn Greenwald, Sandra Lebedy, Catherine Godfrey, Nadia Mady, Amalia Sortland, Sean Glenn, Neil Krishnan, Julia Bromberg, Katrina Norvell, Carly Frankel, and all the team at WME. Novel.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death? This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge the season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.